Hey, I'm JD.
And I'm Bud, and we're the Boxmasters, and you're listening to Everything Fab 4
on Salon.com.
That's right.
Welcome to Everything Fab 4, a podcast focused on fun and intelligent stories about the Beatles. I'm your host, Ken Womack, music culture columnist for Salon.com and a Beatles scholar and historian. No other band, or popular phenomenon for that matter, has enjoyed the global impact the Beatles have and continue to have more than 50 years later. They are part of our human fabric. They created music that continues to bring people together, and just about everyone has their own Beatles story to tell, some that are surprisingly deep and unexpected. This show seeks to draw those stories out in interesting and insightful ways. Remember, it's a Beatles world, and everyone has a story.
And I started checking out all the originals. I was like, man, there's some serious, serious songwriting here. Eleanor Rigby, the first phrase is five bars, but the strings had that kind of rhythmic bounce. So I was like, man, you know what? Let me try to see how this sounds swinging. And I remember when we first started playing it, everybody would get tripped up on that five bar phrase, you know. Boom. Kind of tricky.
Today's guest is Grammy-nominated American jazz guitarist Dan Wilson. Hailing from Akron, Ohio, Wilson cut his teeth at his local church while finding his inspiration and influence from a range of guitar greats, including Wes Montgomery, Charlie Christian, Joe Pass, and George Benson, among others. His musical identity has been shaped by everything from gospel and blues to traditional jazz, hip-hop, and horn players like Sonny Rollins and Joe Henderson. After graduating from Hiram College, Wilson made his recording debut with pianist Joe McBride and performed to worldwide acclaim with Joey DeFrancesco and Christian McBride's Tip City, eventually recording his debut as a band leader with To Whom It May Concern in 2012. Over the years, Wilson has shared the stage with a host of jazz greats, including Eric Marienthal, Russell Malone, Les McCann, Rene Marie, Jeff Hamilton, David Sanborn, and Dave Stryker. In 2017, Wilson earned a Grammy nomination for his work on DeFrancesco's Project Freedom album. He also served as a guitarist on Van Morrison's recent albums, You're Driving Me Crazy and The Prophet Speaks. In 2021, Wilson released Vessels of Wood and Earth, which includes the standout cut, Who Shot John? The album was produced by McBride for his Brother Mister Productions label. In 2022, Wilson was named as a Letter Rising Stars Jazz winner. His latest LP, Things Eternal, features his innovative take on the Beatles' Eleanor Rigby. Writer Michael Toland praised the album, extolling the ways in which Wilson lets the grooves and melodies talk for him, whether he's leaning into R&B with Philip K. Jones's Stickology and Stevie Wonder's Smile Please, or lighting out for the bop territories with Freddie Hubbard's Birdlike and McCoy Tyner's For Tomorrow. Welcome, Dan Wilson.
I wonder if you could start by telling us, you know, when you first got the spark. Did you grow up in a musical family? How did it all start?
Man, you know, I sort of a musical family. Yeah, I didn't realize this until I was like maybe, I don't know, maybe in my teens that she was actually a really good singer. I didn't realize it. She knew like a ton of jazz standards. I mean, like, she had an entire fake book in her head. And it's, you know, when I started learning, she was like, oh, that's cool. You learned, do you know The Shadow of Your Smile? Do you know When I Fall in Love? Oh, do you know Tenderly? I'm like, where was this all along? Where was this the first 13 years of my life? So, but my dad was a musician. He played drums and bass. And then I found out later, when I was in my like later teens that he could play a little bit of piano. I don't know why it never came up, but he showed me how to play drums and bass. And then our church needed, our particular local church needed a guitar player. So we went out to Guitar Center. He got me a guitar and he was like, you're on your own here. And so I just kind of started figuring it out. But I had amazing examples, like in our district, in our church district, there were some just, I mean, top level guitar players. So I would sit behind the front pew and just kind of look over their shoulders and just try to play everything they were playing. But that's how I got my start.
Yeah, I love your story about being a teenager and making these discoveries. Only as teenagers could we miss all of that, right?
Just completely oblivious. it was incredible.
Hidden in plain sight all that time. Do you?
Yeah.
What was your first guitar?
It was an old like a cheap Squire. Yeah, it was a cheap Squire. My dad was like, "If you're not serious about this, I'm not spending a whole bunch of money. So you know, you can get serious first, and then we'll talk about getting you something better." And you know, and I stuck with it. I got borderline obsessed. And my uncle actually ended up giving me a really, really nice guitar. It was a Gibson Howard Roberts. And I have it to this day. It has great sentimental value.
Now, is that your main guitar now?
No, I play the Benedetto Pat Martino's. So when I got the endorsement with Benedetto, I started. I went through a couple of their instruments, and they make some great instruments. But I settled on the Pat Martino because of the versatility and the ease of travel.
Well, those are important considerations. I know so many people who learn to play on a Squire, and it's almost better for you because, you know, it doesn't have the greatest action and et cetera, and it almost makes you work harder.
Yeah, it didn't have the greatest anything. I just, like, you know, I just had to make it work, you know?
Yeah, that's what music is, right? In a way, problem solving.
For sure.
Especially in jazz when you're playing with a group, you know, and you have and I really urge the folks out there to listen to your work, which is, you know, widely available on all of the streaming channels. And I note that that's just a crack group. How do you work to find a band and to be able to create that chemistry, which is, you know, exponentially more difficult in jazz? I've really enjoyed watching, for example, your videos of Who Shot John, for example, and watching, you know, the group, some working from music, at least to get, I guess, the basic structure. How does that evolve?
Man, you know, it's like the age old human experience, you know, repetition, you know, it's just like, and you know, a lot of it is like, I take into account personality. Like all the musicians in the band, we've all studied the music, you know, the history of music. We love everything from Louis Armstrong to Charlie Parker to, you know, to everything that came out today. But, you know, I look for certain personalities that can work together. You know, they've already taken care of being able to play their instrument. Now, can we work together? Can we get along on the road? Can we get along on the bandstand? You know, I take into account their musical interests. Like, for example, the drummer, Dave Throckmorton, we've had a decade-long chemistry. You know, we like a lot of the same stuff. We love Jack DeJohnette. You know, all the kind of the 80s session drummers. You know, we talk about J.R. Robinson, we talk about Jeff Porcaro from Toto, Steve Gadd, Vinny Caliuta. So we kind of hook up on that. We also hook up on like Elvin Jones, Tony Williams, and people like that. So, you know, I try to bring all that to the table. Especially when I write for these musicians, you know, I kind of take into account what's in their wheelhouse. But you know, just really just looking for the right personalities.
I guess in a lot of ways, right, it's like screenwriting where you're writing for particular actors to speak the parts. You're trying to find, or you're writing rather for their voice. Is that correct?
100%. 100%. And it's nice to get to know it. Like, you know, because like, for example, I think I knew that this was going to be a good group when we were after a gig, we're packing up, and without saying anything, everybody starts helping to carry the drummer's equipment back to the car. You know what I mean? So that moment right there, I'm like, okay, yeah, we got a good band here. You know, everybody's not kind of in their own head. We're just like, somebody grabs a bass drum, other person grabs a snare, you know, one person grabs some other hardware. So that's the sign of a good band.
Yeah, it's not just playing, right? It's also having a little class.
Exactly. Like, if we're going to be in a van together for hours on end, you know, I don't want to be with the, you know, super genius who's like tortured for the art. You know, that's no fun.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I know that just almost this unspoken language with you, as you said, with your drummer and with your pianist. You know, there's this interplay that, of course, we as observers can't crack that code. But that's okay. That's great.
Yeah, man. It's. I mean, I feel like I agree with something that Branford Marsalis said. It's not the audience's job to really understand the intricacies of what you're doing. It's your job to make them feel something on a visceral level. And, you know, I always hope that comes across.
Well, it sure does with Who Shot John. And, you know, trolling around the internet, I can tell I'm not the only person to respond to that song. Can you tell me about the origin story with that one and how it developed?
Yeah. So that was, when I was growing up in the church, we used to have these revivals or convocations. So we would have one. There was a Midwestern one. There was a Eastern Regional Convocation that was held in Princess Anne, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore. There's a Western one held in Casa Grande, Arizona, and a Southern one held in Sefner, Florida. So when I would go, we would go to the Eastern Shore. There would be, it's 3 days and three services per day. So the some of the sisters in the church would get these elaborate hairdos and spend hundreds of dollars in these elaborate hairdos to go into a church with hundreds of people and no air conditioning. And so by the end of like song one, you know, their hairdos are completely ruined and sweated out. And so a friend of mine said that some of the sisters would go into these services looking like a million bucks and come out looking like Who Shot John. So I never forgot that. I named the tune Who Shot John.
That's great. Now, as a Beatles guy, I was worried that it was about John Lennon.
<Mm-mm-mm>. No way. That'd be kind of dark.
No, and it was too up tempo for that. That your story is better. I remember, right? Folks getting all dolled up for events like that, and then, you know, in no time, it's all over.
It's done, yeah. Because we were like, we're not like the quiet church that sits down, and you know, people will be out in the aisles dancing, and you know, it was that kind of experience. You know, great place to learn music.
Oh, yeah. And it's amazing how often I talk to folks, musicians who who learned to play singing in church, or, and it was, I think it goes right back right to what you said, repetition. You know, you're going to play at least once a week. You know, yeah. That's what I learned. I learned to sing and play in church because of what you just said. You knew there were going to be one rehearsal at least, and Sunday.
Yeah. And it's not like a, it's not like a home, music is not like a homework assignment. It's a way of life, you know, like even before we picked up an instrument, you had to learn to clap on beat. Cause like we had devotional services. So it wasn't an option for you to just sit down and observe the service. You had to get up, sing and participate. Like everybody in the church was required to do that. So by the time you pick up an instrument, you know, a lot of the problems that a lot of students encounter have been solved already.
We'll be back with more from Dan Wilson after these messages. You're listening to Everything Fab 4 on Salon.com.
I know that you've also done a cover of Eleanor Rigby. Do you have a, where do the Beatles fit inside your repertoire? Do you have a Beatles discovery story back there in the attic somewhere?
Oh yeah. That's in the front room. So the way I kind of got hit to the Beatles genius was actually through George Benson. That album, The Other Side of Abbey Road, and all these great arrangements. I think Don Sebesky might have done those arrangements. I think he might have done the orchestral arrangements. But
that's accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I went backwards. I was like, and I started checking out all the originals. I was like, man, there's some serious songwriting here. And just to see the way the Beatles put phrases together was pretty intricate. Like there's that song "You Never Give Me Your Money."
Mm.
You know, there's a just the way even on the original, you know, just the way they put the phrases together, there will be like 5-bar phrase, 3-bar phrase, and you know, really, really interesting. And Eleanor Rigby, the first phrase is 5 bars, and I was like, man, that would be really cool swinging, you know, and it's just like just seeing how that string arrangement kind of jumped out at me, you know, it's really lively. You know, it's really upfront and really lively, even though the subject matter is really, it's kind of dark.
Yeah. I mean, no one was saved.
Right. Yeah. That's like, you know, guys in there in their socks, you know, it's just like, it's really sad.
Happy ending there. Yeah.
Not at all. But the strings had that kind of rhythmic bounce. So I was like, man, you know what? Let me try to see how this sounds swinging. And I remember when we first started playing it, everybody would get tripped up on that 5-bar phrase, you know, you know, when we would start improvising, everybody's used to hearing things in, you know, 4-bar phrases, but that first 5-bar phrase is kind of tricky.
I like how you guys found the kind of tension and I guess urgency in that song, and really homed in on that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's there. It's like whoever did those string arrangements really kind of put that urgency there.
It was George Martin. Yeah.
That's right. That's George Martin. Yeah.
Yeah, and then he borrowed it from Bernard Herrmann, who did the Hitchcock scores around the same time. That kind of choppy sound like in Psycho.
Psycho, that's right. That's right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah,
it's good stuff. I'm so glad you mentioned the George Benson record. You know, that thing completely holds up.
Yeah, and I think it came out pretty close to when they released Abbey Road.
I think so too. And it just absolutely is a powerhouse, that thing. You know, I'd like to go back, if you will, for a moment to You Never Give Me Your Money, which they made that in May 1969. So it's getting pretty close to the end. But the guitar work in that song, in that original recording, is so organic. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, and I know that this will bother a lot of folks out there, but so what? In a way, that's some of the best guitar playing, period, in their whole story. There's just this organic give and take with those passages that roll from one section of the song to the next. And they never repeat.
Yeah. No. Yeah, it's really interesting, man. Like, I have an arrangement of You Never Give Me Your Money. So I haven't brought it to the masses yet. But it has some of that stuff because it's nice because of like how the guitar marks the section, you know, it's really cool.
Exactly that part. And then it's like, there's almost, and maybe I'm using the language wrong here, but it's almost like there's a resolution, right? Where it's working up to a note and it arrives there and then it goes somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. And the harmony is really unconventional, you know. I like how they end up on that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. All good children go to heaven. It's really a lot of cool elements in that tune.
So if staying in the world of jazz for a moment, what is your Desert Island album? If there was one you had to have, right? You're stuck out there in the middle of nowhere, and there's one record that you'll be referring to for the rest of your days. Hopefully you'll meet like a volleyball or something out there.
Yeah. That I share a last name with.
Yeah, that's right. So, hopefully you guys get along because it's going to be a long time. But yeah, what happens? What album? Man. I know this is a ridiculous question, but...
it's so tough.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking jazz here.
We're talking jazz. You don't have to pick a Beatles album. Oh, maybe you can throw in a Beatles album too if you want.
All right. Oh man, this is a tough one. I'm gonna have to go with probably Milestones, Miles Davis.
Yeah.
That record. When I was learning that record, I kind of was on a deserted island because I was going to Youngstown State University, and my drive was like exactly an hour back and forth. And I would listen to that album Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, my whole trip all the way there and all the way back. So I was for 2 hours, 2 hours a day, I was on a desert island with that album. Nothing else existed.
And is it one of those where you listen to it even today and you still haven't interpreted and mined everything out of it?
Oh, 100%, 100%. Like, there's so many classic moments on there. I think Miles' solo on Straight No Chaser is one of the best solos that's ever been played in jazz. I have a couple. It's one of my Mount Rushmore solos. Then the version of the Ahmad Jamal arrangement of Billy Boy.
Mm.
And Miles doesn't even play on that one. There are no horns on that record. He had the foresight to just be like, I'm going to sit out on this one. And it was just Red Garland, Paul Chambers, and Philly Joe Jones. It's incredible.
His level of confidence was really something, I'm sure like all of us, it wasn't in all parts of his life, but at least when he was making music, he had no peer. I don't know, that one solo you just described, thinking back on that may be the best solo anywhere.
Yeah. It's like, there's no fat on it at all.
Yeah.
I can think of one. There's a Louis Armstrong solo on Potato Head Blues. and where you can really tell, like, he's taking American music to the next level. You know, that, like, he's completely ahead of the pack, and you know, and you can tell it's like reminiscent of maybe like King Oliver or something like that, but you could tell like this is the next step in the music, and the music's going to be changed forever.
Yeah, that's a remarkable thing, isn't it? And I guess that's the lightning in the bottle that, you know, the Beatles captured for a while, that ability to be so far out in front you can't see them.
Mm-hmm.
Their moment. And of course, neither of us are first generation fans, but, you know, coming up with things like Rubber Soul, Revolver, Sergeant Pepper. Yeah, it's in a way that must feel like a desert island when you're doing something nobody else is doing.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, for sure. You know, I can only imagine some of the, like, the pressure that they must have felt, you know, with so many eyes on them and so many kind of hangers on, you know, when you're playing like your jazz gig with 30 people, you know, there's a certain like anonymity that you can, that you learn to appreciate as you become more visible, you know.
You know, some of those eyes, I guess we're hoping for them to fail too.
Oh yeah, for sure. Oh, for sure. Like when anybody gets to that level, you know, you got some people like, oh, they shouldn't have that amount of success, and you know, people. I remember when Michael Jordan was at the height of his career, and. And I remember people saying they were tired of him winning so much. that's an unbelievable thing to say, you know?
somehow it wasn't entertaining anymore.
Right. Yeah, he should just give people a break from winning so much.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's not Little League, you know?
Exactly.
And then even when he's not at the top, he can still pull out the shot, you know? It's some people can just play regardless of the genre, whether it's music or, you know, basketball or what have you. Right. I mean, it's just it's just a skill. I often say to my students, you know, they'll say, wow, we just listened to the White Album or whatever, and what genius it is. And I'll say, I don't know if that's genius. I think genius is knowing that you needed to go in and make the album and show up. Or like you said earlier, I mean, it's a lot of the non-musical things that allow the musical things to be great, like people who chip in and help out, you know, showing up and knowing to show up even when you don't want to is a kind of genius.
For sure. Yeah, man. And you know, there's that, and we talked about that repetition, you know, and I went back and I sometimes go back and listen to interviews of Charlie Parker, and you kind of hear about his habits, his practice habits early on. You know, he's like that interview he did with Paul Desmond. I think it was Paul Desmond, and he was like, "Well, you know, I practiced for 3 months straight, 12 hours a day." Like that right there. It's like, what? 3 months, 12 hours a day. You know, and so that's why I was so kind of upset when the movie Bird came out and it was so focused on his drug use. You know, as if his genius, because, you know, it's more of a romantic story to have like a tortured genius who was addicted to drugs and his life was in shambles, but his genius just came from somewhere else. Because it's a lot less glamorous to see him practicing 12 hours a day for 3 months straight.
Yeah, and I totally agree, because that's the failure of that film. It doesn't capture the work, which is, you got to love the work, right? I mean, the work that it took for him to get there. I was I was talking to the author of one of the Prince biographies, and he was talking about when Prince discovered the guitar. And, you know, he was at a friend's house or what have you. And his dad had a good guitar, and Prince started playing it, and they woke up the next day and he's still playing it.
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah, man. You know, I played with the great Joey DeFrancesco for like 5 years, and just seeing, you know, just being on the road with him for that long, you know, you start to learn a lot about like what genius actually looks like, you know. But that's somebody who had like really like highly developed mental capabilities. Like he had a photographic memory, you know, he could remember people from like 30 years ago. Like he was telling me he had, he remembered seeing Thelonious Monk and Art Blakey, Dizzy Gillespie when he was 2 years old. And he remembered the color of Thelonious Monk's suit jacket. And so, you know, and he, when he was little, all he would want to do was play the organ. So he spent all that time, all that and repetition playing the organ. So when he became an adult, it's like it's easy for him. You know, the Joey DeFrancesco we see, you know, it's like breathing.
Yeah, and all that musical structure and theory he must have learned just by rote.
Yeah, man. I mean, like stuff that. Man, just sometimes on like sound checks, we'd be talking about like, oh man, I'm struggling with Countdown by Coltrane. It's just really tough. He's like, yeah, that's a tough tune. And he starts playing it at like 300 beats per minute. He's like, yeah, and it goes here. And we're just sitting there looking at him like, yeah, I'm gonna pack up and go back to the hotel.
Everything Fab Four is presented by Salon.com, the premier news, politics, innovation, and arts website. For more information, visit everythingfab4.com, where you can learn more about our podcast and my latest Beatles-related books, including John Lennon 1980, The Last Days in the Life, and a forthcoming biography about beloved Beatles roadie Mal Evans. The Everything Fab Four theme song, Seize the Day, is provided courtesy of Black Rabbit, the high-octane Beatles cover band and innovative psychedelic rock project from Rockaway Beach, Queens, in New York City. Like what you heard today on Everything Fab Four? Be sure to subscribe, give us a rating, and recommend the show to your friends. Plus, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at EF4 Podcast. Distributed by Salon, Everything Fab Four is a Wonderwall production. Remember, it's a Beatles world, and everyone has a story.